Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Our features in this edition focus primarily on politics and taxes, with help from correspondents Carolyn Adolph and Deborah Wong. We also learn today commercial advertising is coming to Washington State Parks. There are no immediate plans to brand Mount St. Helens with a Nike swoosh, but you'll want to hear what you're likely to see when you're getting back to nature. This is The Bridge for the week of April 14th. With the Republican presidential race still very much up in the air, the GOP primary in Washington State is more important than ever before. Republicans will be voting on May 24th. The results will determine how the state's 44 GOP delegates vote at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland in July, at least on the first ballot. It's not at all clear who will win the popular vote in the state, Trump, Cruz, Kasich, but one candidate appears to be dominating the contest to pick who becomes a delegate. KUOW's Deborah Wong explains why that's important.
It's a process that's happening largely behind the scenes at schools, churches, libraries, and community centers around the state. On a sunny Saturday morning, more than 100 Republicans from the 5th Legislative District in eastern King County filled a junior high school cafeteria. These delegates have already been elected once at their local precinct caucuses. Now many of them want to move on to the Republican State Convention in Pasco and possibly the Republican National Convention in Cleveland.
Oh, I'm Barbara Hegstrom, and I'm from Duval.
So what are you doing here today?
I'm stumping for Trump.
Barbara Hegstrom sits at a table with a small Trump bumper sticker affixed to the front. She says she hasn't been involved in politics since Ronald Reagan was president, but she came out this year because she loves Trump.
She's not afraid to say what he feels, and that's how the American person is. I don't know if it's the New York in him or what it is, but yeah, that's what appeals to me is boldness.
At her precinct caucus, Hegstrom says half the delegates elected were Trump supporters. Next to her, Ted Cruz supporters sit at their table. It's easily identified by large, colorful posters. David Hickman heads up the Cruz campaign for the district. He's handing out bright red sheets of paper with the names of more than 40 delegates who have pledged loyalty to Ted Cruz.
So what we're trying to do today is we're trying to get as many Cruz delegates elected to the state convention as we can.
So why, you may ask, are the presidential campaigns part of delegate selection? After all, this year, Republicans will vote in a primary, May 24th. Won't voters decide who wins the state? What do individual delegates have to do with it? In most years, electing delegates is something of a formality. They go to the national convention with their marching orders of who to vote for, and that's that. But this year, no candidate may end up with the 1,237 votes he needs to win the nomination on the first ballot. And so the delegates who end up on the convention floor in Cleveland might actually have a lot of power. Here's the Cruz campaign's David Hickman.
If nobody gets the magic 1,237, and the way it's looking, that seems probable, then the delegates at the national convention in the second ballot, delegates can vote their conscience on the second ballot. We're trying to get as many people there that are pro-Cruz, so hopefully he would win the second ballot.
So here's what that could look like. In the primary, let's say Donald Trump wins the most votes. The state's 44 delegates go to the convention, and based on some pretty complicated math, many cast their votes for him. If Trump doesn't win on the first ballot, then the state's delegates are released. They can vote for whomever they choose, Cruz, Kasich, or maybe even someone who's not even running for president right now. And so at this GOP gathering in eastern King County, when people stand at the microphone and ask to be elected to go to the state convention, they make it very clear which candidate they support.
My name is Eric Cotulli, C-O-W-L-E-Y. I am for Donald Trump. I want to go all the way to Cleveland. I believe there's time for change.
Diana Arney. I prefer Kasich, but I think Cruz might be the one to beat Trump, so that if that's what it takes to beat Trump, then I'm willing to go with Cruz.
I'm Patricia Walker, very conservative. I think their only chance to save the Constitution is to support Cruz. Thank you.
From the very beginning, it's clear that Cruz supporters are in the majority. Out of more than 70 people vying for delegate slots, only about a half dozen or so are for Trump.
Okay, and my question to Sergeant Arms, are we ready with the ballots?
And by the end of the balloting, Cruz supporters have taken every single delegate spot. 41 of them are heading to the state convention. Not one Trump supporter made it through. Now, it's hard to know for sure whether this story in eastern King County is being repeated across the state. The state Republican Party isn't keeping track of delegate preferences. But KUOW spoke with more than a dozen GOP officials and party activists across western Washington and found that in most of the contests so far, the Cruz campaign has dominated. Randy Peppel is a Republican strategist and a John Kasich supporter. He says Trump doesn't stand a chance of winning over party activists.
It takes work to win delegates. It takes work to get people to show up for 2 or 3 hours on a Saturday or on a Tuesday night to participate in the delegate selection process. And Donald Trump has never been willing to put in that work, and he hasn't hired people to do it for him.
Trump supporter Barbara Hagstrom admits the campaign needs a ground game. She says she only started organizing 3 days before the district caucus. But Trump supporter Eric Cowley sees a more sinister plot afoot.
I don't like what just happened. It's not fair. They should have a representative to be able to go to Cleveland out of my district that stands for Donald Trump. This thing is an organized thing by Ted Cruz, in my opinion, to steal the nomination in the Republican Party.
The fight for delegates in Washington state is far from over, though. Big contests are scheduled this weekend in Pierce, Snohomish, and Whatcom counties. And the biggest contest of all comes at the Republican State Convention, when 1,500 delegates will choose just 44 people to represent the state at the Republican National Convention in July. I'm Deborah Wong, reporting.
Washington and Oregon are two of the oddest tax neighbors in the Union. More than 40 states use a combination of sales and income taxes to pay for government, but not Washington and Oregon. Washington, no income tax. Oregon, no sales tax. Correspondent Carolyn Adolph went to Portland to take a look at how that works out for citizens in our two states.
We've all done it. A cash register in downtown Portland. And in my case, new yoga pants.
There you go.
Woohoo! Just a little casual sales tax evasion among friends. Oregon is the land of freedom from sales tax, and just a drive away. Washington is the land of freedom from state income tax, which Oregonians cannot experience unless they move. Looks like the people of Washington are winning. However, an unofficial calculation prepared by Washington's Department of Revenue indicates that the state is not. It says that if Washington State had Oregon's tax system, Washington would be $9.5 billion richer, almost double the revenue from taxes. This news does not come as a shock in the Oregon state capital, Salem. Paul Warner is the state's revenue officer. Watching Washington State is part of his job.
We would have to have a 12% sales tax in Oregon to collect the amount of revenue we collect from our personal income tax.
A 12% sales tax would be almost double Washington State's sales tax. And Oregon is not going to do that. Warner has noticed something else about Washington State.
Over time, the sales tax base has declined relative to the economy.
This has been going on for 20 years. Washington's sales tax revenues have been shrinking compared to the size of our economy. So, the economy adds jobs and wealth, and sales tax revenues grow too, but only a little. This is one of the perils of running a state on a sales tax, because people's spending habits have changed. They buy more on the internet, and they pay less state sales tax.
That gap just gets bigger and bigger every year.
This is James McIntyre, Washington State Treasurer, who has been staring at our shrinking pile of revenue for years. If it wasn't for our eroding tax base,
we'd have another $15 billion in the state treasury to be used for education and health care and other social services. So.
Washington's economic growth means, among other things, more people. The state has 100,000 more school-age children to educate than it did in 1995.
If you're going to sustain education, you just can't do it. It's mathematically impossible to sustain it on a shrinking tax base.
Oregon doesn't face this problem, but it has a serious problem of its own. Mark McMullen, Oregon's state economist.
We do get larger swings here during the recessions.
Meaning, when lots of Oregonians lose jobs, the state loses lots of tax revenue. Just when people need government, government is laying people off and making things worse. Mark McMullen.
It's sort of, unfortunately, it's par for the course.
This is one of the perils of running a state on an income tax. In the last recession, Oregon lost more than a tenth of its revenue because people were unemployed. Mark McMullen says people in the capital are still haunted by what happened next.
Pretty painful time for them.
Oregon started cutting school days.
This is Tom Potowski. He's an economics professor at Portland State University. Teachers were laid off, and small towns lost their law enforcement.
I mean, these are serious problems.
So Oregon is looking for a way to make its tax system provide more revenue in the hard times. And it has noticed that Washington State actually has something Oregon might want. Washington's business and occupations tax. It's a percentage of everything a business sells, and the revenue it generates is pretty resilient in a recession. Tom Potowski.
There are people out there thinking about it. The state's trying to figure out what other forms of revenue are there, and also wanting to have revenue sources that tend to be a little more stable.
But Oregon still has no interest in a state sales tax. That is Washington's thing. I'm Carolyn Adolph in Portland, Oregon.
This story was produced in partnership with the Ravish Fiscal Reporting Program at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. Thanks to Carolyn Adolph and to Deborah Wong for our reports. In our next story, we learn that residents of Coos Bay who think a years-long fight over liquefied natural gas terminal is over might be wrong. A Canadian energy company is backing the Jordan Cove terminal. They signed a preliminary deal with a Japanese power company agreeing to purchase 1.5 million tons of liquefied gas annually. The deal comes after the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission denied a permit for the terminal earlier this month. Nick Abraham is with the policy research group, Sightline Institute.
The announcement earlier this month was heralded as this end-all decision that the permit was nixed so that the project was likely dead. But a big part of this was whether they could secure demand for the project.
The natural gas terminal would serve energy markets in Asia, where Abraham says demand has dipped in the last few years. However, the recently signed agreement shows FERC believes the project might still have value to Asia. Supporters argue the terminal will bring jobs to the region. Opponents point out environmental concerns and a 232-mile-long pipeline that would cut through southern and central Oregon. Abraham says FERC cited local opposition to the terminal and pipeline in its reasoning for denying the permit.
What these public hearings for this project have shown, what public outcry has shown, is that the opposition is in much greater numbers than the people trying to push the project through.
Abraham says memories of a natural gas pipeline leak in Porter Ranch, California last October have scared some on the West Coast. 11,000 people were evacuated because of the severity of the leak. Porter Ranch residents are just now returning to their homes. The Port of Vancouver recommended last week that port commissioners vote against a lease extension with the companies backing what would be the nation's largest oil-by-rail terminal. As Conrad Wilson reports, those companies need the extra time to get the state permits.
Earlier this week, backers of the Vancouver Energy Project asked the port to extend a portion of its lease until 2018. Port officials say the recommendation is only about the amendment proposed by the backers of the oil terminal and doesn't affect the current lease. In fact, a spokeswoman says the port remains committed to seeing the project through. Commissioners would need to take a separate action to end the current lease. The terminal's backers have 3 years to get the permits they need, but that 3-year window runs out in August. If the deadline isn't met, the lease allows the port or the project's backers the ability to get out. At this point, it's unlikely the oil terminal will win state approval by August. I'm Conrad Wilson in Vancouver, Washington.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown and California Governor Jerry Brown have signed an agreement to remove 4 dams from the Klamath River. They were joined at the signing by Native American tribal leaders, the Electric Utility Pacific Corps, and other groups interested in restoring the Klamath River to its natural state. Under the agreement now set to move forward, 4 older hydroelectric dams that provide very little power would be removed starting in 2020. Without the dams, water quality on the Klamath is expected to improve and salmon habitats will be restored. U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell was also present for the signing of the agreement. Jewell and the states are working with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in order to bypass Congress, which refused to sign the agreement last year. Pacific Corps will also be a big player in the removal of the dams. Pacific Corps has capped the price of dam removal for its customers at $200 million, and the state of California is expected to pay the remaining balance of the $450 million project. You're listening to The Bridge. Perhaps we should introduce this next story with a Coke jingle. Commercial advertising is coming to Washington State Parks. The state park system will begin placing ads in the parks as early as this summer to make them more self-sustaining. Correspondent Tom Bonsi has more.
The Washington State Parks Commission voted 5-1 to approve guidelines for accepting advertising. Creative Services Manager Sandy Meeling says the agency does not intend to commercialize the parks, though.
So you're not going to see, you know, large billboards. You're not going to see parks renamed.
What you can expect are advertising posters in kiosks, racks with brochures, or directories.
We've got several parks that have roofed accommodations, like our cabins and vacation houses and yurts. Another option could be like what you see at hotels, where you have basically a book directory of local businesses and what they offer.
Meeling says the Parks Administration does not expect this level of advertising to be a big moneymaker, but they're trying everything they can to offset declines in taxpayer funding from the state treasury. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
Meeling says the advertising push will be piloted in 5 state parks in eastern Washington and 5 in western Washington, then be reevaluated by the Parks Commission. She said the 10 test parks have not been chosen yet. A devastating disease that has killed millions of bats in the eastern United States has now been confirmed in the Pacific Northwest. In mid-March, a hiker on a mountain trail east of Seattle found an ailing brown bat. It was confirmed by a government lab to have an advanced case of the fungal disease white nose syndrome. This particular species of bat has been found in all but one county in Washington. This means white nose syndrome could be more broadly spread. Scientists are trying to find other affected bats, as well as trying to determine how the fungus could have made the jump to Washington. This is the first time white-nose syndrome has been found west of the Rockies. Since first being confirmed in 2008, the fungus has been detected in 32 states. Before last week, the disease had only been confirmed as far west as Nebraska. 1,300 miles separate North Bend, Washington, and Nebraska. Molly Mattson is with the Center for Biological Diversity. She says the vast distance makes it unlikely that bats carried it that far. Humans who are unharmed by the disease are the more likely source. She says in order to give the West Coast bats a chance, her organization is pushing for a few measures to prevent further spread of the disease.
We need to make access into caves for non-essential purposes more difficult. And if you're going to do that, you have to be accountable for your actions and make sure that you decontaminate your gear and don't spread the disease around. The Pacific Northwest is a possible new epicenter for the spread of this disease, which has been absolutely devastating to bats in the eastern half of the country.
Farmers on the West Coast could also be affected if bats are devastated like they were in the east. A study by scientists at the U.S. Geological Survey estimates bats save U.S. farmers at least $3 billion a year in pest control. For the fifth year, Liberty Restoration, the nonprofit organization operating Astoria's Liberty Theater, has bestowed the Lady Liberty Awards in recognition of professional achievements, volunteerism, and community contributions. This year recipients, Lori, Julie, and Pam Lum, the sisters who run Lum's Auto Center in Warrenton. Eric Bengel of the Daily Astorian has the story.
Three sisters who occupy the top positions at Lum's Auto Center in Warrenton received Lady Liberty Awards at a luncheon Thursday at the Liberty Theater's McTavish Room. Lori, Julie, and Pam Lum, affectionately known as the Lum Girls, were honored for their professional achievements and their history of volunteerism and contributions to the North Coast community. The women, who are third-generation Chinese Americans, serve on local boards and committees and have set up community giving programs for their employees. Lum's programs focus on children, education, and health and wellness issues. The sisters have also been involved in high-profile community projects. Lori Lum Tuyuka, owner, president, and general manager of Lum's, helped lead the effort to establish the Garden of Surging Waves, a city park recognizing the importance of Chinese immigrants in Astoria's history. Julie Lum, an owner and parts manager, pushed for the development of the city's new athletic complex. And Pam Lum, the dealership's marketing and community outreach manager, helped oversee the recent restoration of the Astoria Column. The Lum sisters took over the family business from their parents, Dave and Shirley Lum, who originally founded Lum's as Toyota of Astoria in 1969. Thursday's ceremony pointed out that, in a male-dominated industry where only about 5% of dealerships are owned and operated by women, the Lum girls stand out. Eric Bengel of the Daily Astorian for Coast Community Radio.
That's all the time we have for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of it or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.